It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore free speech issues now and the U.S. Supreme Court hearing a case next month involving a wedding website designer that is the latest clash between religion, free speech, and LGBTQ plus rights. Should businesses be free to deny certain customers due to the business owner's freedom of speech that extends to their commercial activities? Or should businesses be required to offer their services to everyone? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Hila Karen is Associate Dean for Research and the Paul E. Troosch Professor of Law at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Hila, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good morning. So let's start with 303 Creative versus Alanis and these oral arguments set to take place. You wrote for Slate that this case threatens to, quote, undo decades of civil rights protections. What do you see?
So I see a big danger here, and I know that you framed the case as being about free speech, but I think from the get-go, it's really important to understand that it's also a lot about the belonging of all of us to human society and the quest of the business, in this case, 303 Creative, is really to get an exemption from our decades long of anti-discrimination laws. This is a principle that is not new to anyone. All businesses across the country need to serve everyone. Even before legislation of civil rights law in the 60s, that was a principle of the common law. So there's nothing new going on here, rather than the claim that now a certain group doesn't have to follow this rule while everyone else still needs to serve everyone in the market. And so what's really, really it is about is not only the free speech of the business owners. On the other side, there are groups that are about to be excluded from really places that are very, very important to our common existence together.
How could this ruling open up more legal complexities or problems for certain groups of people in our society?
Because once you accept any right to exclude a group for being what people are, so it's not because someone doesn't have the money or doesn't wear a t-shirt and doesn't respect the business or anything like that. It's based on the behavior of people. So some people object to LGBTQ people, other people object to others. So in the 60s, the principle that was used against mixing the races. And the Supreme Court back then said, you can't do this. That's a frivolous claim, because even if you have sincere beliefs that the races should not be mixed, you cannot just, based on it, reject people from dining in your restaurant. So really, there is no confined principle here. Who is allowed to think what, and for that reason, allowed to reject whom?
So on one side, as you were describing, it's the state's, anti-discrimination law requiring businesses to offer services to everyone, regardless, and that does not limit speech. But on the other side, Lori Smith wants freedom from being coerced into expressing ideas contrary to her beliefs. And so there's this term I want you to dig into for us, expressive businesses, popping up in this argument. Can you explain what's going on there? What does that mean?
So the history is very interesting regarding that. There was a famous case that I'm sure all listeners are aware of. That was litigated a few years back, of a baker in Colorado who refused to sell wedding cake to a same-sex couple. And in that case, the Supreme Court was thinking about the free speech argument that is now being raised and refused to take it, because it said, well, we don't really see where is the expressiveness of a wedding cake. Everyone on the bench thought so, but Justice Thomas, who remarked that really in some cases the freedom of speech may be essential. So it seems to me like this little comment by Justice Thomas really sent out the legal advocacy group of Alliance Defending Freedom to go around the country and recruit people that are beyond bakers in the sense of how intuitively we would think about them as doing something expressive. And I don't mean to say that a web designer is not a creative profession. I do appreciate everyone who is creative in many ways. But so the claim is photographers are different than bakers and web designers and graphic designers. But really, the list is very, very hard to define. And in the briefs to the Supreme Court, the Alliance Defending Freedom that represents 303 Creative is very, very careful to say we don't mean hairdressers. However, they don't list in what they don't mean florists, for example, or even not bakers, which is what was at stake in the famous case I mentioned earlier called Masterpiece Cake Shop. So it's hard to define what's expressive, but what I really want to explain is that's not the expression that here is at stake. No one really ever told 303 Creative or any other business what to say. That's not the principle here. What they wish to do, but they haven't ever done, is to enter the wedding industry, start doing web designs for weddings, which they have never done, only on the condition that if they will do so, they will not have to do so for same-sex couples. So the expressiveness, the message here is gained by the refusal to serve same-sex couples, not by choosing the purple color or the font or any aspect of creativity. The point is to say we're doing weddings, but for us, same-sex couples are not weddings.
We're talking about a court challenge to state laws against discrimination with Hila Karen as our guide law professor at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. You can join in on this case, 303 Creative, 800-642-1234. Hila, you know, this Colorado website designer sued the state over its public accommodation law. And so did this, you know, doing this before, as you mentioned, they had any clients or before they were getting into this type of website clientele. So it begs the question, does this case have standing?
So there is a debate regarding the standing that would sound to most listeners as very technical, mm-hmm. but I think that beyond and courts kind of are in dispute about it, which is part of the legal strategy, I think, of the advocacy group of the Alliance Defending Freedom, because cases get to the Supreme Court based on chaos in the lower courts in the country. So they kind of went around in many, many states to a long list of states. And you said earlier, I think Wisconsin is included. So they have done it in Arizona, Kentucky, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Ohio, Colorado, Virginia, and most recently New York, exactly to get kind of dispute about the standing. So I want to explain the standing point in a less technical way. The way they do this, the businesses, is not because anyone attacked them or is actually trying to force them to do anything. These litigations are before anything happened. Colorado never sued or approached the business owner in this case. And in fact, we don't even know, there is no evidence that anyone that is controversial from her standpoint approached her. So this is in a way not a real case, not a real dispute. And the substantive part of it, the problem here, is that by doing that, there is no actually other side in the litigation. So when the baker in Colorado litigated at the Supreme Court, there was in the picture Charlie and David, the real humans that the baker excluded, and they could voice their humiliation. And their mother, that was one of them's mothers, was there, could explain it was not about the cake. We were so surprised. But in this litigation that I'm talking about now, and it's around the country, there are no victims for real. They were removed because no one actually was hurt yet. And therefore, no anti-discrimination law was operated against anyone yet.
Hmm. Hila Karen with us, Associate Dean for Research and a Law Professor at Southwestern Law School. We discuss anti-discrimination law in a Colorado case taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court at the intersection of free speech and LGBTQ plus rights. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the question of whether a marriage website designer could refuse same-sex marriage couples on the basis that they don't align with her religious beliefs. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments next month in 303 Creative versus Alanis. The group Alliance Defending Freedom published this video about Lori Smith's petition in her own words.
As a Christian artist, I was really excited to step into the wedding industry and use my artistic talents, except there's a Colorado law that prevents me from continuing with my work and forces me to violate my beliefs and speak messages that I don't agree with.
Join in on whether a public accommodation law violates free speech. 800-642-1234. Hila Karen is a law professor at Southwestern Law School and stays with us. Hila, you've been looking at what you call market evangelism, this strategy you see around the country. Can you explain what you mean by that term and where it's gaining traction?
Yes, for sure, Kate. So the point is really to use the marketplace, which supposedly is about getting what we need, right? On a daily basis, we buy, we get services, and it's supposed to be economic, but also fun when we go shopping. And to use this really public arena to achieve ideological message and to spread it. So in your introduction, you were talking about the freedom of speech of the business, but really no one is trying to prevent anyone from speaking about it. We know that we live in a society in which some people have religious beliefs regarding the sexual orientation of others, and whether you agree with it or not, the absolute right is to talk about it. But no one has a right to actually talk about it anytime they want, regardless of consequences. So for example, if you and I are in a concert of Yo-Yo Ma and we paid a lot of money for the tickets.
Oh, I love that. Go ahead.
Right. So no one has the right to say, now I want to speak on stage and deprive anyone else in the concert hall from the ability to listen to Yo-Yo Ma. What we are really committed to as a society and should remain committed to is to give the ability to speak. The video that you just played is a magnificent example because, listen, she's speaking in the public square. They are spreading her voice. Their website is putting a photo of her every week. Yeah, yesterday, in preparation for this conversation, I checked it out, and they dropped another one. So there is really a lot of interviews, a lot of YouTubes, a lot of opportunities to speak. So the question of market evangelism is whether you can use this site, this place, when we go shopping, to actually make your point rather than make your point in the real political public square. So I'm not saying that someone with different opinions should say them quietly, which is, I'm quoting here Justice Alito, that we can't say that, and I agree. But there are so many opportunities. Why the opportunity of rejecting people? And to me, what's so important is humiliating them. This is so humiliating that there are some people that cannot do what all of us can do. We can all shop without thinking about it unless we are in a disfavored group where people are starting to follow us around the store, which is targeting Black shoppers and others, Or it's not different when same-sex couples or LGBTQ people are actually trying to do something very, very innocent, very daily, and then only to hit a sign that says, you're not welcome here. Because part of the battle in this December at the Supreme Court is not only the ability to refuse, but also the ability to announce the refusal. So if you'll imagine that, we're going to end up having a marketplace full of signs, these people are not welcome here, which is an awful sight in my mind. It's a segregated marketplace.
What mental health issues can result from someone being told that their identity is offensive?
So in my work, I dedicate a lot of attention to actually the role of emotions, which is typically not part of how we think about the law. We think the law is rational and very, very cold. And so I studied the topic of humiliation, and actually humiliation has really, really far-reaching results. It's a condition that creates a lot of stress, prolonged stress, and with that comes very, very, very severe set of problems. So the studies outside of law really show that humiliation is one of the most intense emotions. So sometimes people talk about this is going to be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. It's not embarrassment. Embarrassment is what happens to us when we forget to zip up our zipper. Humiliation is really threatening the sense of belonging. It's an emotion that evolution instilled in us. When society suggests to any one of us that we are not as good as others, that would, and we need to belong for our survival. So that's a mark of you are not accepted by your own community. And I think many listeners can even think about the reason for which society made them feel inadequate in this kind of a way. And this is a real threat. It doesn't have to be the LGBTQ group of people. Some people are not being treated for being overweight, and society denounce them. And so there is this struggle of belonging. And I would say, to go back to the marketplace, that the ability to simply go about your day and participate smoothly in the marketplace is a very basic one.
Hmm. Hila Karan with us, law professor at Southwestern Law School, as we talk about a court challenge to state laws against discrimination. Still time, 800-642-1234. Hila, we haven't touched on precedent and this court about Employment Division versus Smith from 1990, what that ruling and how it could impact the 303 creative ruling. What do you see in precedent in this case?
So the interesting thing is that the Alliance Defending Freedom, representing the business here, really wanted the court to hear claims regarding the case of Smith. So the bottom line is that the Supreme Court refused to rediscuss the question of Smith. The principle in Smith is that if we do have a general rule that applies to everyone that has some implication on religion, then everybody needs to obey the rule. This, because it's a general one that applies to everyone, and no religious groups is entitled to exemption from that. So that was on the list of topics to discuss, but the Supreme Court rejected the idea of discussing the free exercise of religion claim of the business, or the idea of maybe abolishing Smith, which is something that people had been talking about. But the only question they put on the table right now is free speech. Among the three claims that the Alliance Defending Freedom wanted them to discuss, they only picked the one regarding free speech that is really, really broad, because that means that not only religious business owners can make claims, but if this case is successful, then a lot of people with a lot of opinions, some of them not connected to religion at all, may argue the same thing.
We only have a few seconds left. Will this case be successful before the High Court?
I hope not, but we all know we are headed into a super majority of Christian conservative judges, so it's really hard to predict. I hope that they will realize that belonging to the marketplace should remain a basic right.
Hila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for listening and talking with me.
Hila Karen is Associate Dean for Research and a Professor of Law at Southwestern Law School. Still time to join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A ministerial exception gives religious institutions some leeway when making employment decisions. They're allowed an exception from certain federal employment discrimination law claims, shielding religious groups from the government interfering with such decisions. But the U.S. Supreme Court could start to weigh in more on where that line is drawn between the First Amendment and religious freedom. Join in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Franklin is Associate Professor of Law at DePaul College of Law, served as a law clerk for the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was Illinois Solicitor General from 2016 to 2019. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. We've been talking about the 303 creative case. I want to make sure that you have some space to weigh in as well. What are your thoughts on that case heading to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure. I think the issue raised by the case is a tricky and difficult one, because I do think there are circumstances under which a person can say that requiring me to comply with anti-discrimination law would violate my First Amendment rights by forcing me to express a message with which I disagree. So, for example, the Supreme Court in a prior case said the state of Massachusetts or the city of Boston couldn't force a St. Patrick's parade organizer to include a gay rights parade float in their parade, because a parade is an inherently expressive activity, right? Mm-hmm. A state surely couldn't force a priest to preside at a same-sex wedding if that would violate the tenets of Roman Catholicism. On the other hand, though, it's easy to see how that principle could be taken way too far. So, for example, we would all agree, I think, that theater is inherently expressive, but we wouldn't want to allow a racist theater company to say no African Americans can come see our plays. And that's because as a society, we believe that combating discrimination is an overriding governmental interest. So the clash here is a real one, but the case is sort of a fake one. And what I mean by that, and your prior guest talked about this too, is this website designer has asked the court for a blanket exemption from Colorado's anti-discrimination law, even though it's never been asked to do a same-sex wedding website. I don't even think it's made any websites for anyone. And it's not clear to me why anyone would ask this particular website designer to design a wedding website for a same-sex couple unless they were trying to make a federal case out of it or sort of trolling, right? So there are no actual facts here. And I think under those circumstances, if I were a judge, I would say I'm not going to strike down this anti-discrimination law sort of across the board as applied to this particular company without knowing the facts of the case.
Well, let's pivot on that, on free speech, to the ministerial exception in, you know, going to this other legal land area. What is the ministerial exception from state and federal discrimination protections? Describe it to us.
Sure. It might be helpful for your listeners just to spend a minute on the legal backdrop here. So federal anti-discrimination laws like Title VII make it illegal to take adverse employment action against someone because of their race or their sex, and there are other statutes that do the same for age and disability. There are also similar state laws in many states. But to take Title VII as an example, Congress has already written in an exception that allows religious institutions to prefer their members of their own religion. So, you know, a synagogue can say, we're not going to hire a Catholic to be our rabbi, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we can fire our rabbi if it turns out he's converted to Buddhism. All of that's in the statute. The so-called ministerial exception is different. It's not written into the statute. It was made up by judges starting in the 1970s, and then the U.S. Supreme Court finally recognized it about 10 years ago. And what the ministerial exception says, Kate, is that if an employee of a religious organization helps that organization carry out its religious mission, then the organization can hire or fire that person without being subject to any anti-discrimination law, federal or state, even with respect to race, sex, age, disability. And the idea here is that the exception, even though it's not in the statute, has to be read into the statute because of the First Amendment, which contains protections for freedom of conscience and for the autonomy of religious institution decision-making. And so the notion is that courts can't second-guess the decisions that are being made by a religious entity about how to select its ministers.
So there, it sounds like there is quite a bit of latitude in this exception, but who qualifies as a minister? I mean, who does this exception apply to?
Well, that's what most of the litigation under this ministerial exception has revolved around, how to determine whether a particular employee counts as a ministerial employee. And the Supreme Court has had a couple of cases about this. And as a result of those two cases, the Supreme Court has made clear that this category, it's not limited to people who have a title like minister or priest or rabbi. Instead, it's a functional test. Does the employee help the institution carry out its religious mission? Does he or she help propagate the faith? And so the court has said, even a lay teacher, even someone like a math teacher, if they're teaching at a Catholic school, and if they, for example, are charged with reading prayers with students for a few minutes at the beginning of the school day, or accompanying students to mass, or being available to counsel students in spiritual matters, if the student asks, that person could be considered a ministerial employee. And often in these sorts of settings, the employment contract will make sure to include sort of mission-focused language to try to make clear, in case there's litigation down the road, that yes, this employee is considered by the institution to be part of their religious mission. And the other thing that the court said in these cases is there needs to be a healthy dose of judicial deference. That is to say, courts should largely defer to the judgments that are being made by the religious employer about whether or not this employee is covered by the ministerial exception. And again, once the employee is covered by the exception, that person is totally unprotected against employment discrimination. They can't sue under state or federal law.
David Franklin with us as we talk about the ministerial exception from anti-discrimination laws, Associate Professor of Law at DePaul College of Law in Chicago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jed is with us from Couderay. Jed, what's on your mind?
Bonjour. Good morning.
Good morning. What is your question?
Thank you for taking my call. It's not so much a question. I concur with Professor Franklin's point that this is kind of like a fake case. I guess I'm just calling for common decency and respect and courtesy, which goes both ways. You know, I'm really exhausted and frustrated by the culture wars. I think they're actually taking real victims, and I think they're being used to rile people up on both sides about issues that are very personal to people. And I think we can all agree that we don't need more division, but we need to kind of unify and live our lives on a daily basis just with that decency and respect. So that's what I hope for the world. And I'm not so much concerned with the marketplace or codification or anything like that. I'm actually just like face to face on a personal level. I just wish other forces wouldn't rile people up to go after each other.
Jed, thank you for those comments. And what is on your mind? David Franklin, what is the impact of the culture wars? Are they hurting America as you look at it through these cases and the legal system?
I think your caller really speaks from a place of wisdom. You know, one of the things about the way our legal culture works, and that's, I think, the aspect of our culture that I can speak to with at least some expertise, is that it's become increasingly focused on claims of right. I have a right, you have a right, you know, which right is going to prevail, right? And I think that there are other ways and better ways of thinking about many legal questions. When the question is one of whose right is going to trump whose, it becomes a kind of winner-takes-all situation. And I think that's where we find ourselves in a lot of these cases. Look, I think there are arguments of good faith to be made on both sides of a case like 303 Creative. But there are also surely ways of resolving these cases that take into account those good faith arguments and take into account the values represented on both sides without saying the First Amendment trumps anti-discrimination law or vice versa. What's at stake in these matters isn't really all that societally important when you sort of zoom out and think about it. Same-sex couples, generally speaking, are going to have other options in terms of who is going to design their wedding website or who's going to bake their cake, to refer to a case that was decided a few years ago. And likewise, right, if a baker says, I don't want to bake cakes for same-sex couples, you can sort of say to them, well, all right, but you can make a standard cake available without having to put language on it in a way that reflects a message with which you disagree. There are compromise solutions available. Unfortunately, I don't think that the current conservative majority on the Supreme Court is in any mood to find those intermediate compromise solutions. And I do think that has the effect of sort of supercharging the culture wars in our country.
DePaul University Associate Professor of Law David Franklin, our guide as we explore the ministerial exception and Supreme Court rulings that relate to a religious organization's employment practices at the intersection of government anti-discrimination law. Still time to talk about religious liberty, about First Amendment, about these exceptions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Supreme Court held in 1952 that religious organizations could freely choose their clergy, protected by the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause. So we explore how the ministerial exception has evolved in rulings recently and where SCOTUS will take free speech next. still time to talk about ministerial exception, why it matters today. 800-642-1234. We have DePaul College of Law faculty David Franklin, who stays with us. Let's bring in Jerry in Appleton. Jerry, what would you like to share?
Good morning, Kate and Professor Franklin. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. My view is that the Republicans have gamed the system and created a conservative Christian supermajority on the Supreme Court. And as we've already seen with Dobbs, they are likely to make decisions that are out of step with what the majority of Americans believe. Professor, what is your opinion on the implications of that trend?
Jerry, thank you. David.
Well, it's a very broad topic. I think there's a lot of truth to that. The Supreme Court historically has not tended to get too out of sync with the broad, sensible consensus of the American people, for better and worse, right? When the American people were not ready to be as anti-racist as they needed to be in, say, the late 19th, early 20th century, the Supreme Court was right along with them. And it wasn't until Brown versus Board of Education in the early 1950s that the court finally sort of pushed the country to a better understanding about the true meaning of equality. But for the most part, the court is a reactive institution, or ought to be. That is to say, it takes the cases that come to it. And in deciding those cases, it reflects what the broad middle of the American public understands and what the broad middle of sort of the legal culture understands the Constitution to mean. That's really not true with respect to some of the decisions that the court has made in recent years, not just the Dobbs decision overruling Roe versus Wade, but, for example, a decision close to 10 years ago that effectively struck down the important parts of the Voting Rights Act, the Citizens United case, and others. And so then the question becomes, well, what happens? What do you do when you've got a Supreme Court whose members have lifetime tenure under our Constitution, when that court gets out of step with where the American people are on these important issues? And it's a difficult question because there aren't a whole lot of tools to respond to it. In theory, Supreme Court justices can be impeached, but it's virtually impossible to succeed in doing that. In theory, the Constitution could be amended, and I'll just say, in my view, should be amended to get rid of lifetime tenure so that Supreme Court justices have, say, a single non-renewable 18-year term. But constitutional amendments are virtually impossible to push through. Now, there's been a certain amount of talk recently about changing the number of justices to increase the size of the court. And it's true that the Constitution, Kate, doesn't say that 9 justices is set in stone. Mm-hmm. Congress can change that number, and it has over our country's history several times. I don't see the political will to do that, and I worry a little bit that if the court were packed with new justices, there would be a kind of a tit for tat, where if the Republican Party gained control of Congress, it would increase the number of justices yet again. So it's a difficult situation for sure. The possibility is there to restrict the jurisdiction of the court, to say that the court can't decide certain kinds of cases. Congress has fairly broad leeway to do that. But again, I don't know that there's political will to make that happen. So in the meantime, I think the best we can do is sort of work within the system that we've got, try to make arguments that will appeal to the justices if possible, try to remind them of the court's role in our society and the fact that there are interpretations of the Constitution that differ from the ones that the current Supreme Court majority seems to favor. I think the newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, has done an excellent job just at oral argument through the questions that she's asking of sort of reminding her colleagues and maybe more importantly, reminding the public of a different way of coming at constitutional questions. Will that be enough to change what the current majority seems determined to do? I doubt it, but there's a long game here. And in that long game, I think it's important to remind people what the stakes are.
Jerry, thanks for the calls. We talk with David Franklin, Associate Professor of Law at DePaul College of Law in Chicago. David, I want to turn to one of your cases. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decided against a client of yours, and you argued that an Illinois music and choir teacher was subjected to a hostile work environment. Why do you think that argument might work?
Yeah, so in our case, and I should say I was part of a excellent team of lawyers on this case who did a fantastic job. We represented Sandor Demkovich, who was a music and choir director at a Catholic church. And he alleged that his supervising priest had subjected him to pervasive verbal abuse and harassment because Sandor was gay and he was planning to marry his partner. Ultimately, he was let go. And he sued the church, not for his firing, because he understood that as a music director, he was a ministerial employee and he couldn't sue the church about hiring or firing decisions. But his argument instead was, look, my case is not about hiring or firing. My case is about a hostile work environment. And Title VII also outlaws that. That's a form of discrimination that federal law makes remedies available for. So it's not about how the church selects its ministers, right? But the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Illinois and Wisconsin, Indiana, disagreed with us. And it held that the ministerial exception encompasses not just hiring and firing decisions, but also the way in which a ministerial employee is supervised on the job, and that this kind of pervasive workplace abuse was apparently part of how the church was supervising its employees. It's not necessarily the way a good boss, I hope, would supervise their employees. But the court said when it comes to a church and its relation with its ministerial employees, we simply can't second guess those supervisory decisions. And so that was the basis of the court's decision in our case.
David, thank you for joining us and taking us on this tour of cases. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate.
David Franklin is an associate professor of law at DePaul College of Law. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.